Everyone hear me? Great. I'm going to get started. So welcome. I'm going to talk today about virtualizing a Microsoft Linux Server 2013. It says planning and architect, but I go a little bit more deeper than that. I go into talking about stressing your environment out to understand what the capability is going to be when you go into your live production environment. My name is Campbell Gunn. I work on the Linux Server team within Microsoft. What was interesting about this particular area was we decided to build our own lab internally using real-world hardware. We actually contacted a hardware vendor that supplied the hardware for us. We actually brought in people from the field, so our Microsoft Consulting Services, and we sat down and said, okay, if we were a customer, what would we do here? And you'll get to see a glimpse of, in fact, what we did and how we approached it. So what I want to talk about today is really understanding and sizing a Linux Server 2013 when you're virtualizing it. I think the interesting here is that one thing I like to get at when I'm explaining this to people is that it is a real-time service. It's not like a web service where you can just move things around and it'll reconnect and everything will be good. Linux Server, if you do that, you're suddenly having dropped calls, your conferences start failing, you lose your video, audio, all right? So you've got to think about this service in a real-time sense. So it makes it very unique, especially when it's virtualized. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to talk about a scenario that we did within our labs, and I could provide some information and some data back to you. I'm going to talk about some key health indicators. There's a sort of a top 10 list that we use, and then as we found with that top 10 list, if anything was outside the parameters that we set, we then did some digger deeping, and there's about 80 of them all up that we actually end up developing. And then I'm going to talk about testing and stressing the environment. Obviously, we do this in a closed lab environment. We're not going to do this in production. We have tools that are available. A lot of people don't realize that this tool is available, which is the Linux Stress tool for 2013. We did have one for 2010. I am curious, who's running Linux Server 2010? Okay, about half. Who's running Linux Server 2013? About half again. Virtualized? Wow, okay, that's good to see. Non-virtualized. That's okay, because when we get into the KHIs and testing and stressing, you can actually apply that to the physical world as well. It's not just not just the virtualization side. One last question, VMware. I'm not going to talk about VMware, sorry. But I will talk about particular points that VMware does that's different to Hyper-V and some gotchas on that. Okay, I'm going to give you some gotchas. I'm Microsoft hat on. I'm not going to talk about VMware. We are trying to work with VMware now to get them to take this material and then do their appropriate lab testing and so forth, right? Because their product's a little bit different to Windows and Hyper-V. So this is sort of my first slide here of why do we virtualize? And given the fact that I think majority of people here are virtualizing, you've obviously bought into this and understand this, where we're trying to reduce our infrastructure costs. That one's an interesting one because your hosts are generally a lot bigger than your physical environment, so it's sort of a little bit of an oxymoron there. But there are other reasons why we virtualize, and that we can spin up our VMs, we can create our environments a lot quicker than we could typically do in a physical environment. The other thing, too, is that reducing total cost of ownership. You have all of the VMs sitting on the host. You can decrease your maintenance cost for hardware. So generally what hardware vendors like to do, as we all know, they like to put you in a maintenance agreement for 3 years and then you've got to turn your hardware over for those customers to do it. We do it in Microsoft, so it is challenging. Also, the other things, too, is allows you to standardize your operating system, the process that you take with your operating system and your virtualized platform. I think it also allows you to do better capacity planning as well. So if you have a particular VM that has your corporate applications and you spin it up for maybe a business unit within your organization, you've done some work in the lab, you generally know what the hit's gonna be from a capacity point of view. And then you can see some operational efficiencies, such as business continuity, operational flexibility, having your standbys so that you can have your DR or HA strategy, Also, one thing that we specifically look inside Microsoft, which I think you guys too, is actually the server to administration ratio, right? How many administrators does it take to look after so many virtualized or physical hosts as well as the virtualized environment, the guests sitting on top of that. So again, with Link Server 2013, we allowed you to virtualize all the workloads. You can see a list of there. It's designed to really take whatever you can do physical, you can do virtualized. That's probably an important point to note. Obviously, when we're running a virtualized platform, that we abstract the resources from that. So we're going from the host through to the guest. And I'll talk a little bit of things, some of the benefits of using Server 2012, R2, or just regular. Is anyone running Windows Server 2008 R2 SP2 or 2008 R2? Okay, not for Link. Yeah, don't. Just FYI. I'll indicate why. The other things too is that you can use templates and install the OS and then install Link on top of that. I think what's interesting here too is that your CPU resources can be consumed a fair bit, especially if you're doing media transcoding. So the video, the codec that's actually doing that, that does require a lot of CPU resources. So think about how you allocate your CPUs, and we'll talk a bit about that. The other one that always comes up as a concern is network. And I'll talk a little bit about that, but I'm conscious to people's belief network isn't a problem. Actually, your main problem will be is disk. Link Server is very disk IO because it's running SQL, and you need to be conscious about that, and we'll talk about that one. So I'm going to get into the specifics of hypervisor, and this is Hyper-V in particular. So the validated hypervisors that we did, Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V, and also is Windows Hyper-V Server 2012. As well as R2, you can see there as a list. Not recommended, so I'm going to talk a little. I got you to show hands. There was a few people actually running. Windows 2008 R2 is supported, but what you've got to be conscious of is that it's not recommended. And part of the reason is if anyone has done any deep diving into Hyper-V for 2008 R2, is that it's limited to 4 cores, right? The number of vCPU cores. Link doesn't like that. You'll hit performance issues, definitely, right? Because we're asking for 6 cores or dual proc hex core for our physical, and then you also need to look at how you translate that into virtual. Interesting parts there is that one thing that you need to note with 2008 R2 is that compared, why do we go 2008 R2 and up? There were significant updates that were in 2008 that addressed network packet loss. In fact, we worked with the Windows team to ensure that network packet loss was eliminated. 2008, Windows Server 2008 is not supported. So whenever you're virtualizing, and I think a majority of you, given you're all using virtualization or some type of virtualization today, there's always an overhead involved, all right? It's software on software. As opposed to if you're using a physical environment or a physical platform, you've got direct plumbing to the hardware. So generally, we've seen around anywhere between 6 to 10% overhead. You need to factor that in. Also, depending on what else with the guest and depending on the workload that you're wanting to utilize, whether it be IMP, so internet messaging or presence, or whether it's voice or whether it's video or combination of all, you need to think about additional resources that you need to provide. It involves both your CPU, affects certainly your CPU and memory, and remember also I mentioned is the disk I/O. You can see in the next point there that there's an increase of the physical servers due to the virtualization layer. So a lot of people say, well, I can consolidate. Yes, but you also then need to expand based on the type of things that Link does, and I'll talk a little bit about that one. Here you can see the virtual machine template, image templates. So you can you cannot run sysprep itself to create the machine after Link Server 2013 because of what we do is when you install Link Server, it takes the name, the server name, and stamps it into the front ends. So, and it's unique to that server, so when you try to sysprep it again, it's the same name and it gets confused, all right? That's the reason why. We have a few customers that hit that problem. So what we do recommend is using your OS templates. As you know, there's a number of prerequisites that's required when you go and install Link Server. You would have encountered that. There's prerequisites. So certainly use sysprep in your templating, OS templating, to include those prereqs. This is probably the interesting one, and I mentioned this at the very beginning of my presentation. Live migration and quick migration is not supported. The reason for that is that it's a real-time service. So if you start shifting your VHD or VXD across to another host, the guest, you're going to have problems, right? You're going to disconnect your users, especially if they're in a conference, they're doing any audio or video. IMMP is not too bad, because what happens is that when you move it, you'll actually see, or when you shut down one host and then you have a standby host and you bring that up for your guest for your front end, you'll see that the contact list within your link client will actually bounce and you'll see it repopulate again. But conferencing, audio and video, for obvious reasons, is going to be affected. So we don't recommend that. Well, actually, we don't support it. If you do need to, like I mentioned, if you do need to move virtual machines across from one host to another, the best way to do is actually shut down them, move them, and then bring them back up again. Obviously, when you do that, your conferences are going to be affected by that. Dynamic memory. So dynamic memory is not supported on any of the roles. The reason being is that Link Server is expecting to have a stable platform for full memory CPU. Right? It gets so in VMware is where I took a little bit of it. The oversubscribing of memory and the oversubscribing of CPU, and also with Hyper-V, don't do. Link Server gets very upset with that. What else? Yeah. Let's talk about virtual disks. So using the fixed size disks, don't use dynamic disks. Obviously, because performance is affected, if you're expanding the disk size at the same time as, in fact, the data's being written, especially on the front ends, because we've moved everything now from a workload perspective to the front ends, you will affect the front ends greatly. Back ends, you can get away with that, because really it's just storing the blob storage. Also, too, is that also you need to think about is differentiating disks and dynamic expanding disks not supported. Partly also, as I mentioned here, is that the storage can be overcommitted. Be careful about doing checkpointing, all right? Because when you checkpoint, it's going to create a secondary drive, all right, on the virtual machine. So it's going to go on the host. It's going to create a secondary drive. And what it does then is it actually, for the new drive, it's going to be doing the write while it's doing the read operation from both drives. And you hit a performance there by doing that. Everyone knows that with hypervisor, and in this case Hyper-V, you have two types of disks or disk access. You've got the virtual IDE and virtual SCSI. You obviously need the virtual IDE controller to actually boot up. And then beyond that, you should be using the virtual SCSI controller. And one thing, too, is that with the IDE, it's limited to three connected disks. Excuse me. Virtual SCSI can actually have 64 disks. Also, one thing that I find a lot of customers do with the virtual SCSI is that it supports the hot add and removal of disks. Virtual IDE does not. So this gives you better performance and optimize your performance as well as the flexibility. Again, I find a lot of customers do is they actually use some type of fiber channel storage to optimize their disk storage as well. So guest storage, well, it depends on a number of factors, right? So storage is locally attached or some type of SAN. Again, there's two methods that are provided with Windows Server 2012. Hyper-V is in-guest iSCSI storage, and also whether you're using a virtual fiber channel. So common best practices I like to put here is that the operating system boot drive must be mapped to the virtual IDE, so you boot up on that. Then all the SQL Server workloads and binaries use the virtual IDE or the operating system drive. And then the guest servers need to move between the iSCSI targets that are directly exposed to the guest server. Those people who already installed Link Server 2013 or 2010 for that matter, when you actually go to install it using the defaults, it'll actually look at your disk partitioning and try to set the default disk partitioning. So it'll try and put the transaction logs in the greatest partition that's free space. So think about your partitioning strategy as well, your disk partitioning strategy. Just because you can alter that, there's a commandlet to actually, when you install CS database, you can actually set the parameter and say where, how you want to lay out your subsystem for that. So let's talk a little bit about host requirements. So with this, obviously I mentioned about resource over allocation. Don't do that, all right? You want to have a one-to-one. Mixing physical and virtual servers. This is one that comes up a lot. So really, the golden rule is when you have a pool of, say, front ends, that whole pool either can be all physical or virtual. You can't say within, say, a user pool, the front ends, I want half to be virtual and half to be physical, all right? It doesn't, don't do it. There's a lot of problems that actually occur arising from that. Performance issues are the big one, so we do not support that. You can have then, within your user pool, obviously you have the back end, your front end. So front ends can be virtualized, the back end can be physical, or vice versa. We don't have any rules specific around that. Obviously, from a performance and stress point of view, evaluate it, see if that makes sense. And the reason for that is it's depending on your workload, it's depending on the modality that you're using, whether it be IMNP only, whether it be that, as well as audio and video conferencing, you obviously need to test this. Physical to virtual CPU ratio, so it should be not oversubscribed, I mentioned that before. Antivirus, this is probably an important one, is only deploy the antivirus software on the VM root partition. Obviously gonna cause performance issues if obviously it starts scanning and can affect the performance. The other thing too to think about is other workloads that generally don't recommend, but you can do it, and that is other workloads such as the directory if you're using 2010. Generally don't virtualize that. And other things such as the file storage, so your DFS share or your share location, you don't necessarily have to virtualize that, but you can. In our lab, we actually virtualized everything just to see what would happen. Again, some of the more host requirements are host redundancy. So obviously you want to think about your redundancy strategy, your HADR strategy. Again, we talk a little bit about this and I go into the details about you're obviously not going to put all your front ends on one host. Kind of would be a problem if that host went down, you've lost all your front ends. So you want to stripe your, think of it like a striping strategy, right? You want to have your front end spread across multiple hosts. Therefore, if one goes, then your user load's going to be shifted. Those users then obviously will be affected in the sense that it will go, it will only give them the dial tone, right? Host networking. This is one that's an interesting one, is that each host must have a dedicated network adapter. Obviously, the network support for the actual host itself and the traffic that it generates, you want to keep that separate. That's shared usage so that your guests, you want to have a dedicated NIC for your guest for Link Server. And probably the most important part to this is your front ends and back ends, all right, to have that. It gives you that support. Multipath I.O., again, is something you want to consider for the storage for your back end server. You can use VMQ, though with Hyper-V Server 2012, it becomes less of a problem. Those people running 2008 R2, you need your VMQ driver that gives you that support from the guest down to the operating system's NIC or to the physical NIC. VMQ drivers are only supported for Broadcom and Intel, so that's something to think about. 9 times out of 10 when I visit a customer's site and they're having network performance related issues with Hyper-V and they're running 2008 R2, generally it's VMQ driver related. They haven't updated the latest driver, and generally that is where it hits them. For Server 2012, we have the Server I.O., and that capability then allows you to directly plumb from your guest directly down to the NIC on your host to get the performance that you need. Again, that support is provided by your hardware vendor. Obviously, it's a BIOS related feature. HP generally gets you to update the latest BIOS to be able to support that, and they have particular generation of boards that support that. So it's something you need to contact your hardware vendor on. So as I mentioned, you want to have dedicated NIC for your guests. Shared usage not supported. Correct sizing to handle the workload. We'll talk a little bit about that. There's also NIC teaming. So if you want to team for redundancy around and performance, you can nick team. A lot of customers, in fact, go in and enable the VLAN tagging for the host nick as well. And you can implement multiple VLANs, depending on your environment, how large your environment is, to really optimize the network traffic for your front ends to your clients, and then front ends to back ends. A lot of customers go and actually separate that and use VLANs to do that. Let's talk a little bit about the guest requirements. So here are the guest core requirements here, that Hyper-V is not the limitation to the number of cores on the server, Windows Server 2012. So that was the best thing that I saw when Server 2012 was announced. We were looking very closely that they removed the restriction on the amount of vCores that could be supported. And that really allowed us to then really take, or allowed our customers, you guys, to take advantage of the capabilities of Blink and more so. Other third-party hypervisors may be limited to 8 cores. I'm not sure on VMware, but I have seen it in some of the Linux hypervisor platforms. Link Server 2013 running on physical hardware does not have any in the limit to the CPU cores as well. The more hardware you can throw at it, the better it'll be. Obviously, there's a price associated with that, a cost. The guest operating system, so Windows Server 2012, 2012 R2 is preferred, and then also Windows Server 28 R2. Reason SP2 is not supported is that we didn't test it. Not to say you can't run it, we didn't test it in our labs when SP2 came out. At the time when we were doing evaluation and doing the testing, it was actually done on Windows Server 2008 R2. You might find that, obviously, in the future, we may look at that. So another interesting part to do with Hyper-V is legacy versus the synthetic virtual NIC. You can see there that if you use a legacy adapter, you actually get lower data transfer, and because it's emulating, in fact, the Intel 2140-based PCI Faster network adapter. So synthetic adapters are preferred. The reason for this is it gives you the dedicated VM bus, so the virtual machine bus. It dedicated utilizes that, and this allows you part of the virtual to physical NIC communication when you're using a synthetic adapter. This is on top of the single root I/O virtualization, or SRIOV. And again, that's only available in Windows Server 2012. It actually takes extensions. It has extensions there on the PCI Express devices. And that gives you that separation. And really what it's trying to do is act as a virtual switch between the two. And if you look at it, if you're using single root I/O virtualization, then the actual legacy network adapter is not supported anyway. So what I'm trying to highlight is you can have both synthetic and single root I/O virtualization together. If you don't have single root I/O virtualization, then you can either use the legacy or synthetic, all right? If you're using the single root I/O, then you can't obviously use the legacy network. Does that make any sense? Guest requirements, IP version 4 and IP version 6, not recommended to mix the two, though you can. Obviously, you're going to get a performance hit as it's traversing through the stack, through the IPv, V4 and the V6. Preference is if it's a V4 network only, use V4, disable your V6. If it's a V6 only, then disable your V4. It's a preferred option there. This is an interesting one, right? Disable virtual DVD and CD drives in the guest, right? Obviously, it's going to tie up resources when it needs to provide for that device, so you want to try and provide as much resources back to the VM guest. So let's talk about, because some people here are using Link Server 2010. Let's just talk a little bit about Link Server 2013, and we made some architectural changes between when we moved from 2010 to 2013. And that is that really the back-end database, we've offloaded a lot of the functionality from the back-ends to the front-ends here, and you can see what's occurred here. So we've no longer used the back-end as real-time data store for the link pool, for the user pool. So really its job is to provide the overall persistent blob storage of data that comes from the front-end servers. And also, this is obviously different to 2010. And so what we've done is then we've moved all of that capabilities to the front end, right? It's handling all the transactions for the server. And we obviously, with the AV conferencing server, it's now part of the front end server role. And we no longer separate monitoring nor the archive server role. they're running as services on the front end. One thing to think about too is that we support the H.264 codec for the video requirements. That also now is running on the front end. So you can see there's a lot of things now running on the front end. So with that, if you're using conferencing, audio, video, you need to think about the computational CPU that you need for that as well, because the codec requires a lot of that. Okay, let's talk a little bit about sizing environment. If we look at the Hyper-V guests, you can see here, obviously the guests we can have 4 cores, the 12 cores or 8 cores. Notice the different layout here. Typically, if I look at this particular one, the 12 cores, this is used primarily for the front ends, back ends. I had a customer ask me earlier before I started the session about standard edition. I am going to talk a little bit about standard edition. We actually did test with standard edition as well in our labs. So typically, you're looking around this. With the disks, it's an interesting part, right? You need to note that you need at least a minimum of 4 15K RPM drives or 6 10K RPM drives. And this is primarily because Link Server 2013 and 2010, for that matter, is very SQL bound. All right, SQL Server Express is installed everywhere, obviously in the back end, SQL Server Enterprise. And so, therefore, you need to have the very fast drives to be able to cater for the I/O aspect of that. If you can also dedicate the disks or the VXD disks for that particular guest for SQL Server is another added benefit as well, and then your partitioning strategy like that. So you can see you've got to coordinate a lot with how you're going to partition, how you're going to actually partition at the logical level down on the physical VXD drives and so forth to give you best performance. If you look at the 8 cores and memory 16, this is great for your edge servers. You're virtualizing your edge servers. Again, you have a pool of edge servers and also for your directors. This is another interesting one, and I'll get more into this when you use the link stress tool. If you're stressing or wanting to use should be using the link stress tool to test in a lab environment, this is the ideal site for your guest. Think of it like a client that actually runs the stress agents against your user pool, against your environment. This is sort of the hardware requirements that we recommend for that. Okay. There we go. So sizing environments, so scaling the roles. So on the server-side front ends, you're typically thinking about the 333 or 3,000-odd users per front end. For the back end, it can scale up to 40,000 users within the link pool, the user pool. Generally, what will happen is the reason it's 40,000 for the back end and only 3,000-odd for the front end is generally what will happen is you will never sort of oversaturate your back end because you're scaling out your front end, right? It's catering for what you're going to do on your front ends. If you're going to scale those front ends and the amount of users there, then it's going to hit the back end. Obviously, you won't necessarily hit that. So the edge, for an edge pool, you can see there the count is 40,000 users for the link pool. And then your stress agent, you'll get about 2,500 users for the stress agent that you're running. So let's talk about the lab scenario. So this, in Microsoft, we actually, as I mentioned earlier, we took some folks from the field, Microsoft Consulting Services, as well as our perf and stress team. We actually propped a lab up. We actually used, just out of New York, one of the customer environment centers where we bring customers in and they get to, and we set it all up based on their environment and we go through and test with the customer. We actually did this in conjunction with the lab out of New York. And what we found, the observations were, we actually conducted multiple tests, and you'll see that we actually used all different modalities. We took to close to 20,000 users per front end and see if it falls over, and then we started reducing it down within the KHIs. What we found for the optimal solution was 10,000 users in a user pool with 3 front ends, to give you some idea. I'll talk a little bit about what hardware we use very shortly. So what we did find is running with that, and this is all modalities, right? This is not just IMMP. We turned on everything. Everything you could think of, we turned on. And we used, who's familiar with the default user profile on TechNet? Wow, this is scary. One person, two people, sort of one hand, one and a half maybe. Go to TechNet and do a search on the Link Server 2013 user profiling. So what this does is it characterizes a typical workload that happens across 40,000 users and then alter it to meet what your requirements within your environment. All right, it's a very useful document to be able to use in conjunction with the Link Stress Tool and setting different parameters and explains why those parameters, what they do, and so forth. It did, in this particular case, when we did in the lab, like I mentioned, is that it did produce high resource utilization. We were getting sustained around 80% CPU utilization on the vCores. But within our key health indicators, we kept it within the limits. One thing that's really important to do here is just be continually test this. Don't do this in your production environment. Go and have a closed lab environment and conduct the tests, right? And this is one thing that I find a lot of customers get caught up with is, oh, well, I just install it and it's all going to work straight out of the box, right? And Link is not that product to do that. It's a communications product, right? It's similar to when you're setting up your PBX, the work that you have to do about that and make sure that everything is set up. Link Server's communications product, it's going to have this, the same things that you'll need to do as if we're using a traditional voice system. And also, too, is that the reason you do need to test it is I can't capture every permutation that you guys are using, right? I don't know everybody's hardware configuration, network environment, locations, etc. All right, so obviously to test it is... you're obviously with different hardware and user models too. I don't know what your users are using today, what they want to use tomorrow, and forecasting it. Nice thing about having a lab environment is then you can look at, okay, my users today are only using IMMP. Great, I'm gonna stress test that. 6 months down the road, because obviously they get a taste of it, your users, and they say, oh, now I want to do audio, now I want to do video. Again, you come back, you use the Link Stress Tool in your lab, and now start looking at that with those modalities, IMMP, voice, and video. Then your user base comes back to you and says, well, we want to do conferencing. We want to ditch those other third-party products, right? And a bit of a plug there. And so you need to stress test it as well on that point with all those modalities. This is something that will evolve. Hopefully, your users can say, we want everything. That'd be great. But generally, we find that doesn't happen, right? You want to test it and run a pilot and so forth. So here's an example what we did in our labs. You can see here the topology, and this topology is probably no different to what you run within your own environments. You can see there that we've got a couple of edge servers, that we have your hardware load balancing. We then obviously have our user pools. We also have Exchange server running there. We have our Active Directory. We have WAX servers as well, Windows Application Servers, so that you can actually store your PowerPoint presentations and then be able to allow that through your conference and you can cycle through it and things like that. One thing to note here is that our host configuration had there is that each virtual server was configured with 12 cores and 32 gig of RAM was allocated. And what we actually did, and this is the interesting part, and it caused a lot of confusion in 2010, you use the exact same size, if possible, use the exact same sizing requirements for physical for virtual. So we've got out of the situation where, well, for physical, this is how many cores you need, and then for virtual, you need these amount of cores, and here's the amount of... It caused a lot of confusion during the 2010 timeframe. So we said, nope, let's standardize. Let's say that whatever's physical and virtual, same. Now, that creates an interesting dilemma of how much hardware your host has then can provide back up to your guest and how many guests you can run. Again, you need to test this. You can see also the hardware configuration that we had as well. A little bit hard to read there, but this is just showing, in fact, our guests that are running. Our guests are running. Our disk subsystem we're setting up, our network plumbing for that as well. And this is actually on one, I think it's on one, host. So the scenario, here's the host storage configuration, what we did. So we actually had internal and external disks. You can see, in fact, what we did with the arrays, the capacity of that as well. And here's the IOPS that we're getting out of that. So it's pretty substantial here. I'm not sure, in fact, your environments are like that. Maybe. We have some customers that, in fact, are well beyond this, that can easily cater for this. So here's the placement. So the virtual machine placement. And I sort of hinted that earlier in this presentation, and that is that you're not going to have all your front ends sitting on one host, right? That's giving you great high availability. Well, it'll give you high availability, maybe, but your disaster recovery would be really bad. So you can see how we've spread across our front ends, and you can see we've sort of like striped them in our back ends. Remember, we had three front ends. Our back ends, you can see also the edges, your OWASP as well. We also had some reserves based on the logical procs that we're using. Remember, we've got 32 in this case. The interesting part too is keep your virtual servers in the same pool is going to improve resilience. What we're trying to do is think about the configuration in the rack, right? Your host machines and your guests, depending on how you've racked at the top of the rack for your tool, make sure that in fact they're sitting in the same rack. I found that we were messing around. We found some performance issues where we actually put it in a different rack. And so when it came to the top of the rack and out, we found there was performance because the front ends were trying to communicate to each other all the time. So we found that became a bit of an issue. If you can try and put all your hosts and then your guests in one rack, especially just predominantly for the user pool was the one that we found for that, because there's a lot of communication that's happening within the pool. So what we did find, and this was a little bit alarming first, and then we realized what was happening, is that when you use the stress tool, there's this ramp-up stage that happens, and it varies a little bit. We found it was generally around 30 minutes it took to ramp up as we turned on. Because basically what's happening is the clients are all logging in. The stress tool does this. You run these stress agents, and they're all logging into the front end all at the same time. So it's sort of like a Monday morning, everyone comes into work and they log in and your system hits that. So it's actually a good way to see what the effects are that, and we call it the ramp up. So what happened with that is that it took about 30 minutes. We had 10,000 users. It took about 30 minutes for that ramp up to occur. During that, what's happening with that ramp up is the Link Stress Tool's loading its configuration files. I'm going to show you what those files are all about. Users were logging in, as I mentioned earlier. And also, too, is that Link server is starting to complete some background tasks, that is from the front ends to the back end. Remember, there's blob storage, and it's trying to set that all up and get that steady. Plus, obviously, presence information is starting to light up within the pool, so that creates some additional traffic and ramp up. So here's an example of what actually happened with the ramp up. And you can see here that this is showing your processor time. So there was a ramp up that occurred. Let me get the mouse over here. So you can see the ramp up that occurred, and then it went pretty significant. And we tried to keep it within 80%. Remember that we're trying to stress this environment out. We actually originally did 20,000 users on the three front ends, and it literally fell over. So we thought, oh, let's go down to 15. Then we went to 12.5. Then we went down to 10. We found 10 for a three front end was around the sweet spot. So we kept, this was all, with all modalities too. So everything, all workloads were running on this. We weren't just trying just singular ones. We didn't do any of that testing. We wanted to see what happens if we ran all workloads in the three front-end configuration. So here's the interesting part that we discovered. SQL Server Express. One thing with SQL Server Express is that because it's the name Express, it's actually hard-coded to the first four cores, no matter what, on the front end. So you need to be conscious of that. And so what happens is that within our scenario, because we put 10,000 users, had to ramp up and sustain, we found that the CPU was at 80%, and one of the reasons was because of SQL Server Express. In particular, it's associated, we know, with on the front ends is the RTC local SQL Server instance, right? And so there's an article, actually a TechNet article, that shows why that's the case. Obviously, it's from a product point of view. Enterprise Edition doesn't have that limitation. Express does. So we found that we were getting above 90% utilization. So it indicates with the particular enterprise, three front ends was already at full capacity. So what happens then if you've got front ends and you're in this situation? To bring that CPU utilization down, you actually provision another front end. All right. So that will give you that, and then home the users on that particular front end. So one thing to look at if you are hitting that issue with SQL Server Express is there's a couple of key KHIs. You can see two there is the queue latency and the Sprock latency. So the queue latency is the amount of time in milliseconds that you're going to have take the request to leave the front ends and queue towards the back ends. So that's one that you need to look at. The Sprock latency is the amount of time it takes from the SQL Server database to process the request. So as a user's connecting, as it's doing presence, changing its presence information, obviously that's actually queuing up against the RTC local. And that actually also has an effect on CPU utilization by doing that, believe it or not, depending on the amount of users that you have, obviously. So here's a good example of what happened here with SQL Server Express, 10,000 users, three front ends. And these are on different front ends on the RTC local. So with this, we've actually got the assigned cores for RTC locals, the instances here. So we've got, where is it? Yeah, the 00010203. So you can see that here that the four processors are being highly utilized for the processing. So when we're analyzing the results from the Link Server Stress Tool, we found that CPU utilization across all calls was allocated to the guest, and you should be inspected to see if that's on average. You can see that we've got a number of spikes. These are actually occurred with activities such as opening a conference and having multiple users come in for that conference. Remember, I was going to ask a question, but I won't. Just your knowledge here. So when those users come and connect to the front end, so one that initiated and created that conference will hit that home front end, and everyone will go and join that front end. So you'll see the different spikes from that based on the type of workload that you use. So we found that it was continually while we did unload was around 90%. We wanted to bring that back to, we found after a period of time, we'd run them for at least 24 hours. We'd do at least two stress runs based on the user. If we found it was above the KHIs or outside the limits of the KHIs, we'd then bring down the user count again, or we'd add another front end. In this case, we only had three, so our option was to reduce the user count. So we went through that iterative process. Again, this is showing some characteristics here. At the beginning here of ramp up, you can see some effects of ramp up. This was, in fact, when conferencing happened. And then this was just normal traffic here. One of my normals, IMP, or IM particular. What else was there? Voice and video. We had reach clients as well. So we had ALWA. We had some mobility clients running. You'll see that in the tool, in the stress tool, how you can configure that as well. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. The question is that obviously this is a simulated client, and what is the actual user's experience? What would they experience in this situation? It's pretty difficult today to actually know that apart from looking at this data. It's a good question. I think just looking at the experience, obviously when a conferencing is occurring at that beginning point there, time period, you can see at this period that obviously the connection to the conference might be slower than usual. That's some of the experiences that will happen. Generally, if it's above, we found above 90%, you'd actually get things like the jitter issues start creeping in because it's just trying to process it, especially video, because the codec is sitting between the CPU. We found generally there was issues around that. Never found login actually was an issue per se. There was that initial ramp up, but login from a user experience, would actually be fairly trivial. It wouldn't be a big issue there. That's an interesting point too. That's something to probably take back to the product group and think, how do we actually show that it, what the user's experience would be.
The LSS manual actually
says that you can actually put live users in there to judge that. You can put them alongside your the simulated users. We didn't do that. We actually ran all the simulated users using the Link Stress Tool. But you're right, you can run the users to really gain an experience with all the other workloads happening by the simulated side, see, okay, what's the user experience? So yeah, certainly you could do that. But within the tool itself, you can't. That's a good point. So let's talk a little bit about the stress tooling. I'm going to move through this fairly quickly, and the reason for it is I'm actually going to demonstrate it and talk about some. There's some gotchas too that we discovered with using the tool that I want to, especially around reach, and I'll highlight that within the reach. So here, the first tool that I'm showing you is actually going in and provisioning the users. This allows us to create our users and groups, enable users for Link. Obviously, when you're using this tool, you need to have administrative permissions, Active Directory, domain admin is probably the best one to have for that. It generates the contact list and creates the test location information there. Then showing, obviously, the contacts. This is changing the average contacts per user. Obviously, that's going to cause some process utilization if you've got a number of contacts, because we utilize the contact information from that, from the Link front ends. This now is going into the stress tool. So this is actually the stress agents. One thing to think about here, and I want to highlight this point, actually. It's a good point. For our users using the stress agent or acting as the client, what we did was we actually picked a host and number of guests, and we ran the guest as clients. Okay to do that given what we had. If possible, it'd be great if you actually had physical clients that actually you could run the stress agent on. In fact, internally, we actually have physical clients stress agents that we run on to actually continually stress it that way. So if possible, So apart from having the server virtualized, you obviously need to have clients. You can virtualize them all physical as well, and you need a number of clients to do that. You can run multiple instances of the stress client on the particular machine as well. With that, you're actually specifying things such as details of how you want the modalities to be utilized and setting them to test. You can set the load variables such as the number and frequency, for example, of PSDN calls. You need to be careful too of the features that you enable and configure them. So for instance, the reach client, and we found this in particular one, the reach client, so the ELWA, UCWA, they can increase the process utilization on the front ends. We saw significant of that. In fact, when we saw the 10,000 users with the reach, and we actually turned reach on, and I'll show you the settings for that as well, we found that we were getting about close to 20% increase in CPU processor utilization of 10,000 users when we turned reach on. When we turned reach off, we found it, obviously dropped in that. So that's something to think about as well. Which brings me into the demo. It's hopefully my machine's not locked. Okay. So I brought up both the tools here. The first one is obviously provisioning your users. So here, the front-end pool, FQDN for that, the name prefix, password, you can see the SIP domain and the account domain, organizational unit. Obviously, I'm going to hit the Active Directory doing this, so I need to have domain administration privileges, the actual voice enabled, whether I've got a voice enabled or not, and obviously the phone area code here, number of users that I want, and to have the start index of 0 here. The contacts creation, so the average contacts per user, and whether it's fixed or whether it grows, the average contact groups per user, and then whether you've got any federation set for that as well. Distribution lists, so here the name, the number of distribution lists, the prefix for that, the members, the number of members in that distribution list, and the maximum, so the min-max. And then obviously here, which is an interesting one, the info for the service config, so number of subnets and switches, these things, natural endpoints, number of addresses, and clients. So you run this first, set up all your users, and then you switch to the actual load configuration tool. And obviously, for obvious reasons, the user settings you want to match to what's actually in what you provisioned. And here you're setting in your internal, your access proxy, or the pool FQDN, your external. So some of these things you already need to have, you already got documented anyway. Your POP percentage, The number of available machines, so the client machines, so obviously depending on how many you have, you obviously increase that. The general scenarios here, so here's an interesting one. So instant messaging, for example, you can set the low, medium, and high. So 33%, 50%, 100, nearly, I think it's like 90% for high. And then you can go custom, whether you want external conferencing, large conferencing. Here's a gotcha for this, right? To hit the advance button and start changing these values, you need to make sure that it's on custom. Even though if you put low and you hit advance and do this, it won't take them. All right, it's a bit of a gotcha on that one. I found that one was a little bit irritating. Yeah, I think it's documented as well. Also, too, if I go in and set some, let's say, custom for the audio conferencing, and I'm going to think which one it does this. I think it's Reach does this. Yeah, application sharing. I'll do the Reach. Reach does something interesting here, too. I'll show you. So obviously go through, set data collaboration. Within that, for example, you can set the number of WAC sessions you want. You start going in and setting the details. Static conferencing percentage, right, based on the number of users, conversations per hour. The easiest way, if you're initially setting this up, is take the, remember I mentioned earlier in the presentation about the default user profile? Take the default user profile and go and set the settings per that, right? And that's a good baseline to set, and then go and start tweaking it as you see fit, as you see based on your hardware, based on the modalities that you've selected as well. Distribution list expansion, you can go and set. Address book web query response groups, so your RGS. Go and set your RGS in here. I'll just show you some of the advanced settings here. So you can set your end index, number of calls per hour for RGS, average call length in seconds as well. So this, I find a lot of people stress that particular for RGS out information. So voice scenarios, setting your VoIP level, your PSTN gateway, you can see the details here, call park service. Reach is one that I want to talk about. You've got your additional settings here. With your Kerberos, I'll talk about, you shouldn't set Kerberos, it actually should be NTLM, but I'll show you also under the covers to do that as well. I found there was an issue with that. It just was taking default settings. You couldn't customize the settings. If I go into the load level and specify the advance, I'm trying to work out which one it does it. This one, it's weird with the tool. Give me a weird error. It's load level. Now it won't do it for me. There's one where you select custom, and I forget, there's one you have to change, and you go to, there's one setting here. Maybe I didn't do it for data collab. It's one where you don't set the settings, you say, oh, they're good, and you close it, and then you want to move the next one. It brings up this dialogue asking you to change the item, and it'll tell you what you need to change. But it's frustrating when you first realize that it's there. Mobility, there's a UCWA. If you're going to have the load level for your P2P instant messaging and audio, and then also you get a summary at the end of the details here. So you can go and customize the range if you want to as well. So you can go in and set the different customizations for this, showing you the number of clients, and then I can generate the files and go off and generate the files on that. Let's do this. Yeah, got a question.
Yeah, can you throttle the bandwidth to simulate front end, you know, in one site and hold off this in another site?
Not through the tool. You could do that at the network layer, for example, and you want to throttle the network and see the effects of that. Is that what you're asking? So you could do some type of cost service. You could say, I want to use a quality of service and then start doing the throttling and turn over on the cost service, especially if you've got multiple VLANs, you can cross on the VLANs. So you leave the front end and back end VLAN as is, as normal, and then from your front end to your clients on that VLAN, then you can start doing cost service on the VLAN and then start throttling the network, the amount of, for example, the speed of the network and things like that. So I've just created, hopefully it's created all the files that I want. Yes. So here, I'm going to talk a little bit about this, but one thing I want to show you. So these are all the clients that generate. Remember I said that, in fact, I want to generate 8 clients? So I need to take this particular, and I should have created the batch file, hopefully, in here. Yep. So here are all the settings that I went and gone and set in their XML file. So if I go and have a look at reach, and I want to edit, and I want to go down. Where is it? Let me try that one. I want to show you there's a setting, and I mentioned it with Kerberos and NTLM. Just trying to find it now. Yeah, so in the UCY configuration, notice it's set to true here. You need to set that to false, and then there's the authentication that it uses needs to be set to NTLM. So you saw with the Kerberos, you need to set that to NTLM. NTLM, if you don't, what happens is that it takes the default settings regardless. It doesn't know how to change settings. We actually found that it was actually generating high CPU utilization, and we kept changing the reach number of reach sessions, and we wondered why it wasn't changing. So we talked to our performance team, and they said that, in fact, you need to set it to NTLM and not Kerberos to actually allow the settings to take over. So just be conscious of that one. I'll talk about the batch file very shortly. So let me switch back to the presentation. So where you'll find it is actually in the reach. It's called the SIP auth method. And you need to set it to NTLM to cover all tests. Really, the only one that you can really set that, it's a particular file, and I should have brought it up. Actually, I might bring it up again. Is it in there? Let me just do this. There it is. So this is the one I was talking about here, is the SIP auth method. So you'd set the Kerberos. You would change that to NTLM, right? And, yeah, I think that's the one. Reason being is that the contacts per user, if you've got it set to Kerberos, the number of contacts per user will have a processor impact. By setting it into NTLM, you reduce that. We discovered it in our lab, so it was quite interesting. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about testing and say, you saw the tool, how do I take the tool and now apply it to a testing environment and the testing methodology that I'm going to use. Let's talk about that one. So here, testing methodology to use is verify that your environment obviously is functional. Make sure your network infrastructure is set up. Make sure that you've got your gateways to set up. We actually had gateways set up in our environment and actually simulating external clients coming in. Try and simulate as much of your environment and test in your test environment. Also, run tests for at least 24 hours, right? So based on the number of clients that you have, the stress agents running on, at least run them for 24 hours and then run it again. We found that it was a great way of verifying whether our tests are, and for those people, you know, you want a baseline and then you want to see if the baseline changes. So we did that every time when we went from 20,000 users down to 15,000 users down to 12.5 down to 10,000. We ran all the tests twice to verify what was happening. And then also use controlled clients. Try not to have anything else, running on the clients, right? Just the stress tool, tool. So here's what I showed you with the link load configuration tool. You saw, in fact, the different clients here. So you'd install this folder, install the stress tool, the link stress tool. You'd actually take this folder and actually place it onto your stress agent, the client. So this actually goes, and you saw the XML files, which is actually the configuration files. And created for the stress agent. So what happens, there's checkbox here creating the actual client batch file. Notice I selected it as well. What that essentially does here is it actually goes in and looks at you run the batch file, and it goes and runs the stress tool and then goes through and runs within that batch file, it goes and runs the tool-generated tests. So literally, when you open up the batch file, it's got these lines here. You saw the XML files. All right, it'll have this line, and for the, in this case, IAM client 01 XML, it'll have this next line, same executable with the file for the next XML file. So let's say reach IAM, right? And it'll continue going through all of the XML files based on the, what you've configured in the link stress configuration tool. I think the important part too is make sure that stress agent is running. So start up all your clients first, then start up all your backend. They'll start communicating and so forth. Stress and performance here. So for those people who haven't used the, you're all going to go back and use the Link Stress tool now, aren't you? A lot of people. I'm sort of a bit puzzled why people don't know the tools available or there. Anyway, perform stress testing on the targeted deployment infrastructure. These are pretty straightforward for the tool. They can obviously simulate a particular usage pattern. So take the default user profile, look at what your users are anticipating to do, configure it using the defaults, then alter it, saying, okay, my users are more PSDN heavy, my users could be more conferencing heavy, and obviously alter to meet that. What I generally recommend to customers is just take the default user profile first, configure it, run the tests, set your baseline, right? At that point, then start altering it. Again, here, you can just simulate the individual workloads if you need to. You can see the other points there. I'm not going to... probably the only other thing that really to note there is generally I find people go into the lab and start running the stress tool is when they've actually finished with all their technical design and they're about... And just before they're about to pilot, they'll start stressing the environment to see what it's going to be like. I have... had discussions with customers where they'll have an environment that's going to be the production environment, but they haven't commissioned it yet, and they'll actually do the stressing in there to see what it's going to affect. That's okay, as long as it's controlled, as long as there's no other network utilization or network traffic happening at that particular time. You want it in a very sterile environment because it's a test. The last point there, and remember that you need to have clients as well to be able to simulate the stress testing, whether they're physical clients running the stress agent or whether they're virtualized. So let's talk about key health indicators because I've so far been talking about this a lot. There are 10 key, and I'm going to show you very shortly, 10 critical key health indicators that provide the basis of what we class as a good pass. The ease of checking all the indicators is about 82 key health indicators. It's in the capacity guide. It's not in the same location as virtualization. However, we have two, just to let you know, we have two white papers that you can download off TechNet. One is, in fact, the planning and architecture, and the other one is actually deployment and stressing. So we actually have two separate white papers. The stress and performance white paper, you can actually use that with these KHIs for your physical environment, not only for your virtualized, but also for your physical. If you find that there's no critical issues with those 10 KHIs, then you can continue on and do some more stressing there. If you find that there are some issues with those 10 critical KHIs, then you need to go in and look at the rest of the KHIs and see what's happening. Obviously, there's some problem that's being masked, and you want to find out what the root cause is. There's the location for the network planning and monitoring and troubleshooting. That's where you can get all of the KHIs. Here's, in fact, a complete list of the 10 key health indicators. You can see, obviously, the CPU utilization is one. The next one that I always look at is the physical disk, the average disk seconds write. So less than 10 milliseconds is green. Anywhere from 10 to 25 is yellow, and 25 is red. All right, you've got, remember, it's very disk-bound. A couple of options if you're hitting that. It may be that you've got too many users on a particular front end, and you may need to spread your user load out and have additional front ends. The other indicator could be the way you've configured your disk subsystem, both at a physical level and a logical level. So you need to reevaluate how you did your disk subsystem. Other points there is the SQL Server buffer and the page life expectancy. That's one that I've seen that Basically, this tells on average, you can see here, that how long data page will stay in cache. This is interesting if you look at things such as an LATP system, which needs to have at least 300 or 5 minutes. When under 300, then this is going to actually indicate that there's a poor index design. Generally, we have background tasks that go and clean up the index, but this is something you need to look at. You'll notice there's a lot of background tasks, that ramp up as well that's occurring. That's some of the activity that's happening as well, is on the page life expectancy. If it continually becomes a problem, so it's less than 300, you get down to like 100, generally what that indicates is you may not have enough memory, right? There's a potential you're starving the VM, the guest of memory. So you may need to increase the memory for that particular VM. Here's a little bit more on the key health indicators. This is just showing you here that you various components here. So if you suspect, this is after you looked at your 10 key health indicators, you said there's something else wrong, I need to go down further and do some analysis. So here's where you can actually dive into your front ends, look at your audio, video, IM MCUs, too many control units, your web components, if you're using the web, your SIP stack, getting it down into list and down to SQL and then down into your actual, in some cases here, your physical as well as your virtual CPU disk memory and network. So there's really something to think about here is go and add these to your performance counter. So you may want to start, as you saw in the previous illustrations here, not only are we just simulating the traffic, we also want to run our perf counters, and you saw all the perf counters, those 10 key health indicators you're going to run and collect all this data. It does amass a lot of data. We found that we were collecting everything in our virtualized environment that we did in our lab, all the front ends, back ends, edges, and so forth. So here's, in fact, some of the actual counter names for the ASAVI MCU. So you can see the actual counters that are determining the health state on these various components here. So I went through that fairly quickly because I wanted to leave some time for questions. There's always questions. So what I tried to do in this presentation is give you an idea of understanding and sizing Link Server 2013. So you realize now that this is something that you simply just say, oh, I'll just throw it on my existing virtualized infrastructure and everything will be great and work. Also show you, in fact, how we did in Microsoft to give you some guidance. If those people who've done virtualization in 2010 would have realized that the white paper was a little bit lacking, and I ferried calls for the next 12 months as a result. So that's why with this particular two papers, we wanted to make sure that we answered all the questions. And perf counters was the biggest one, right? How do I know my environment's performing the way it does? So hence we went and did it in real life. Also, the KHI is providing that and performance metrics. And then also testing and stressing approach as well, how we approach that, tools, what they mean, some of the gotchas that you saw with Kerberos and NTLM. All right. So don't forget that we've got the Garage Series Live that's happening, so again, it's happening daily. Also, you've got various resources that are available to you, so don't forget to do those resources. Please do an eval, okay? You've got a chance to win an Xbox One. And then also evaluate the session. We can use the QR code to do that. So I'll hand over now to questions, because there's always questions. If possible, please use the microphone, otherwise I've got to repeat the questions, and I may not get it. Is it on? We good for the mics? Yep. Go for it.
Does the SCOM management packs include the KHI indicators?
The what, sorry?
The SCOM management,
SCOM management packs. That's a good question. I don't know, actually. That's a really good question. We actually didn't use the SCOM packs, the link SCOM packs, actually, when we did the test, and we just did the performance count. Assumes you could coordinate the two anyway, right? You can always set that within SCOM and Systems Center's Operation Manager and configure it appropriately. So you can add, if there was any counters that were missing or you wanted to collect that, you could obviously add them to capture that information. The nice thing about, you know, you can also capture what's happening in the host environment as well as the guests using SCOM. So sure. You also may want to use, notice we didn't focus on any of the things such as connectivity of presence information or OWA connectivity for IM and P. You also could use SCOM to do that with different management packs. So yeah, I definitely use that, sort of a mirroring up of the two. I think, was it the slidey? No, any go? Oh, yeah. What would I recommend? Okay, I'd recommend dedicated. If you can do dedicated, great. The problem is there's a cost associated with doing that. If you want to share, then obviously you want to test it. All right, you want to simulate what the effects are. It depends on what those other workloads are. Depends on what hardware you're using. It depends on what modalities your users are using. How many users you have. Sort of how long's a piece of string? Sorry, I'm probably not giving it. But recommendation is it's dedicated, right? Obviously, because you could see some of the details just on 10,000 users, free front ends, what we did in the lab, the type of performance that you need to be conscious of when you're doing that.
Thank you.
No problem.
So we're right now on 2010 on the VMware.
Uh-huh.
And even though there's great things about Hyper-V,
yep.
It's just not easy for us to change completely within the whole organization.
Sure.
So what is the timeline for the VMware support or testing done with VMware?
That's a good question, and you're probably not going to like this answer. You need to approach VMware. You need to talk to your account manager or talk to your technical folk from VMware and ask them, right? I think it's an interesting one. We're saying, okay, we had this SVVP, which is a server virtualization program, and it shows, in fact, all the virtualization partners. And if you read that carefully, it says that it's on the partner's prerogative to go and do virtualization testing. We're quite happy to work with VMware, if they approach us and say, look, we want to do. If they find a critical bug in our product, we're quite happy to help them, resolve that bug. You know, we treat VMware like a customer, right? There's no difference there.
So basically, as we plan on our roadmap, we need to look at timeline with VMware and decide if we go virtual for 2030 migration or we have to
sure.
Do physical.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously I don't know your business. It's a business decision of what virtualization platform you use. I'd encourage you to put pressure on VMware.
Okay.
To ask them to say, hey, when are you going to do some testing around VMware and Link Server 2013? Exactly. That was going to be my next statement. You can use the Link Stress tool and all the details that you saw apart from the virtualization aspect for VMware. So you can go in and stress test your VMware environment with Link Server 2013 using these details here.
Yeah, sure.
We don't
but
limit
then,
you doing that.
I mean, you know how much effort you put just to testing Hyper-V, so then it becomes we validate, it's a lot of effort for just doing that whole validation with. So I think the same rule apply? Because we have some, you didn't touch the virtualized client side. So is that same rule apply for if we have some Citrix stuff, like Zen App stuff, and it also it's
yes,
there?
I would, obviously I would stress test it. Citrix clients, I don't know.
Okay.
That part, I really don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry I don't have more data on that.
Yeah, and the next question regarding to the stress tool and the KHI, because you're talking about more for virtual, is that same thing we can use for the physical server testing or those?
Yes. Yeah, this can be all done in the Link Stress tool, the different modalities, the default user profile, having the number of clients. This all can be also done in physical, right, as well
mm-hmm.
as virtual. The KHIs, you saw that they actually work on the physical side as well as the virtual side. Remember, we tried to, and it was one of, I think, the third slide or fourth slide in, we said that the same hardware requirements
mm-hmm.
for both, whether it be physical, whether it be virtual. Right?
Okay.
We tried, when we put this information together and we produced the white papers, we wanted to standardize. We paid the price a little bit with 2010, a Link Server 2010, when there was differences there and people got confused and they said, well, how many users, which hardware, how much hardware do I need, and so forth.
Okay, another question regarding the stress test. I'm not, if okay, I have so many questions, sorry. So you're talking about you only use three front-end server with 10,000 user.
Yes.
Then the result you give us is like 40,000 user maximum per pool. So is that kind of, you do like, because the maximum is 12 servers per pool, so you multiply that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So in the lab, I can test with the three front-end server, and then.
Yeah, the three front-end, like, that's a really good point, actually. The three front-end server, the reason we have three, and preferably four, yeah. is because of Windows Fabric and upgrade yeah. domain sitting under the covers.
Okay.
Right? If you have, obviously it's not going to work if you have less than three.
Mm-hmm,
right,
yeah.
because it needs, if those people know upgrade domains provides us a resiliency function that if you lose one of your front ends, it's allowing to move those users across, okay, onto those other two front ends. And if you have, the more front ends you can have, obviously the better Windows Fabric upgrade domain will be happy about.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Okay. Well, let other people ask.
Hi. Hi. Actually, we might have deduced, I've just been involved in a project where I was using LSS quite heavily. I'm not up at your level, but I just wanted to share some thoughts that I had.
Yeah, sure.
There's constant reference in the documentation to clients,
yes.
and that's misleading because actually they're server operating systems.
Yeah,
it's not a client. It's not a client as such. You need Windows Server.
Right.
The other thing is that we found it very useful to plug the link performance counter objects into Perfmon, then you can actually see things like number of IM messages per second and so on and so forth, which along with all the other good stuff.
Yep.
And last but not least, I was also, for my sins, responsible for writing a lot of the test cases.
Yep.
And you know, loading it like this with LSS and using the KHI has actually gave me a lot of test cases that I could give to the testing people and say, you know, this is what we expect it to achieve, and these are the key health indicators that you should be seeing. So that was very valuable.
So that you're obviously downloaded the white papers and
yeah.
you're reading.
Great, yeah, yeah.
That's good to hear. Thank you. I appreciate that. That was the real big thing that you know, from 2010 to 2013, when people were asking about virtualizing, you know, 2013, but there was lacking in 2010. There wasn't these key health indicators. Another interesting part I want to touch on just. Before we finish up, I don't think there's any more questions, but this is a really interesting part. So obviously the hardware requirements for Link Server are quite high. What happens if we've got like 200 users, 150 users? Yeah. So standard edition, this applies to standard edition, where you're standard edition, you get everything and you virtualize that. You can still run, and I encourage it obviously to run the Link Stress Tool against standard edition. We roughly got about the standard edition and the amount of hardware you saw, we got about 1,500 users on standard edition. So that's something to take note of as well. I found that was interesting. You need more standard editions, yeah. And obviously with standard edition, you don't get, like, comparison to enterprise edition, you don't get the HADR strategy, you're failing over pools and so forth. So you need to be conscious of that. That obviously if something goes wrong with that standard edition, you're gonna take down time as a result. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Because it was a kind of showstopper for us, so I want to verify here.
Uh-huh.
So you mentioned the dedicated adapter for the host.
Yep.
So the host is shared environment for different applications.
Mm-hmm.
So you see we need to have a dedicated adapter just for link traffic?
That's correct.
Is that hard requirement or?
Yeah, it is actually, because you can think about the traffic that you're going to generate mm-hmm. from link. If you're sharing that with, say, the operating system, you're going to cause performance issues. And if you're using these key health indicators,
mm-hmm.
it's very hard to determine then the workload that you're going to, the performance issues or stress details.
So you guys have tested with shared adapter?
No, we haven't. No. We did it. We were dedicated.
So if we do share, is there a supportability issue? Because lots of time we go to Premier, they say, the product team say, it's not tested, so it's not supported. It's best effort, but.
Correct. You actually bring an interesting one of support. Let me talk about that one, too. We're still trying to filter this information out to support, because generally when customers pick up the phone and they say, hey, I've got this problem with Link Server, it's not performing, blah, blah, blah. First thing support says is, here's the minimum hardware requirements. Are you meeting them? Right? And then you say, well, I'm doing that. They're like, oh, well, you know, when you get those minimum hard requirements, then come to us. So what we want to try and do is provide this collateral to support, so when they call up, they say, okay, let's talk about those 10 critical KHIs. Is there anything wrong with that? Okay, now let's delve in a little bit deeper. What's your disk subsystem? So that they can have intelligent conversations with you to understand the environment so that they can help you get through that. It may ultimately come down to hardware resources, right? Let's be honest. But there's got to be that negotiation, that conversation. I think that's the important part. All right. Thank you.